Thank you for listening to the Shanghai Community Fellowship Podcast. To find out more about the SCF community, listen to sermons, and upcoming events, visit us at shanghaifellowship.org. Welcome, everybody, to our conversation here on Palm Sunday. Although this is Palm Sunday, we're not actually going to be talking about the triumphal entry. We are going to be talking today about another bit of the story of Passion Week, and that is Good Friday, what happens on what we call Good Friday. In other words, today we're going to be looking in Matthew chapter 27, specifically at the trial of Jesus before Pilate, what happens to Jesus there in the praetorium, or in that court of Pilate's court, and then his crucifixion and death on the cross. And so we're going to be, that's what we're going to be talking about today, actually, which also is happening this week. Because for one reason, we're not going to see you again until next Sunday. And when we see you next Sunday, we'll be celebrating the resurrection of Jesus. So that's where our thoughts and hearts are going today, just reflecting on the life of Christ and particularly the death of Christ. And so we're going to be looking into Matthew chapter 27. So you can get a Bible now and you want to take a look at that. The text is going to be on your screen as well. But that's where we're headed and what we'll be talking about today. Again, Ruth is with me and Josh is back. And so together we'll be discussing this. I want to just say a few things about Matthew's gospel and those who receive it. You know, remembering that in the gospels, and today we're talking about Matthew in particular, there are really two levels of, well, really three levels going on here all at the same time. All right, so Matthew's telling us a story about Jesus in real time, what's happening to him, Pilate, and all the main characters that are around Jesus that day. And we're going to be reading about that. But at the same time, Matthew is actually writing to a group of Christians, his community, his church, that probably lived maybe 30 or 40 years after the trial and crucifixion of Jesus. So Matthew has something really strong to say to Christ's followers who live after these events. And of course, maybe the next level would be then you and I. We're here living in 2020, and right now we're in Shanghai here, but I know there are people listening all over the world today. So this story and its power and its majesty, and you're going to see all of that, I think, as we read it, is still speaking to us today and where we live. So you get this story so deep and rich and really kind of unfolding it at multiple levels here. You know, one of the things I think you're going to see, and this is something that struck me as I was reading this particular passage this week, is how the story, it felt like, builds. You know, there's lots of good stuff that happens before Matthew 27 verse 11, which is where we're going to start. And there will be other things that happen, of course, after verse 54, where we stop today. But in those verses from 11 to 54, it's building. The drama is building. The tension is building. Jesus is on trial before Pilate, and that exchange between Pilate and Jesus. We're going to take a closer look at that. And then, you know, Jesus leaves that scene, and he's being mishandled and mistreated by the soldiers in Pilate's court. And then, you know, there's the crucifixion. He's being taken to the cross, and the cross till Golgotha, to Calvary's hill. And, you know, the whole thing is just building, and it's very powerfully. And so I think you'll see that as you read it and as you hear us talk today. So what I want to do is right now is I'm going to read a larger bit of these verses. I'm going to start with chapter 27, as I said, and verse number 11. And then we'll go on for about, I think about in the 20s or verses 20 something, and then we'll stop and then we'll get a chance to talk. So here we go. Meanwhile, Jesus stood before the governor, and the governor asked him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" "You have said so," Jesus replied. And when he was accused by the chief priests and the elders, he gave no answer. Jesus gave no answer. Then Pilate asked him, "Don't you hear the testimony that they are bringing against you? But Jesus made no reply, not even to a single charge, to the great amazement of the governor, Pilate. Now, it was the governor's custom at the festival to release a prisoner, the Passover festival, by the way, to release a prisoner chosen by the crowd. At that time, they had a well-known prisoner there whose name was Jesus Barabbas. So when the crowd had gathered, Pilate asked them, "Which one do you want me to release to you, Jesus Barabbas or Jesus who was called the Messiah?" For he knew it was out of self-interest that they had handed Jesus over to him. Now, while Pilate was sitting on the judge's seat, his wife sent him a message saying, "Don't have anything to do with this innocent man, for I have suffered a great deal today in a dream because of him." But the chief priests and the elders persuaded the crowd to ask for Barabbas and to have Jesus executed. Governor Pilate asked, "Which of the two do you want me to release to you?" "Barabbas," they answered. "What shall I do then with Jesus who is called the Messiah?" Pilate asked. They all answered at once, "Crucify him." "Why? What crime has he committed?" asked Pilate. But they shouted all the louder, "Crucify him." When Pilate saw that he was getting nowhere, but that instead an uproar was starting, he took water, he washed his hands in front of the crowd. "I am innocent of this man's blood," he said. "It's your responsibility." And all the people answered, "His blood is on us and on our children." Verse number 26, and we'll stop after this one. Then he released Barabbas to them, but he had Jesus flogged and handed him over to be crucified. So this is how the story begins. Jesus is on trial with Pilate. We were just talking before we went on camera. You know, this is a familiar story to the three of us, but all of us read it again this week. What were some things that maybe stood out to you, made that kind of first impression when you read it again? We'll start with you, Ruth.
Yeah, for me, the thing that really stood out to me this time was his innocence and how Matthew really went to a lot of trouble, a lot of emphasis to really show that Jesus is innocent. And even this verse 19, where he writes that Pilate's wife sent him this message that she had had this dream and it was a sign from God and it was kind of torturing her. And for Romans, this was kind of like a sign from God. And why would God send Pilate's wife a dream when, you know, when it was God's will for him to be crucified? It wasn't going to stop or change things. Why? It just feels like it doesn't make any sense. If it's God's will that he be crucified, you would think he's just making the way. But it looks like that they're really sending a lot of signs that Pilate didn't believe that Jesus was guilty, believed that he was innocent, that his wife was getting signs from God that he was innocent, and that he found no real reason to crucify him, but that the crowd would not hear it. And even this whole exchange with Barabbas is also like just unreal.
I like the idea, or it was expressed someplace else and I saw it and read it, that, you know, you get the feeling, it's like one of those stories where when you look back on it, you ask yourself, why didn't somebody do something about that? I mean, it felt like it was just kind of taking a life of its own, and it was spinning out of control. And if you had the privilege, opportunity to look backward in hindsight, you would say, you could kind of look back at the story and say, things were just unraveling. Why didn't someone stop and say, hey, this man is innocent, right?
I was thinking about that similar thing too, Ruth. It made me think, like, man, why are people so bloodthirsty? Like, where did this bloodlust come from? And like why do people get so full of like lust for like violence and blood or of this sort, and they get all righteous in their beliefs? Like, they believed without a shadow of doubt that like what they're doing was the right thing, and they thought it was the righteous thing to do, right? And I think that translates beyond to just this moment. in history too. It's like in so many moments in history, people firmly believed that they were doing the right thing at the cost of justice, even at the cost of like they overrode justice here. Pilate himself said, "There's this person is innocent," but like the lust for blood is just so high. They're so thirsty for it that they even overlooked justice. And I think it happens over and over, over and over, not just this moment. And I think, you know, like, it's just kind of an indication of, like the man's heart. Like, man's heart can go there and often goes there. And that's a good question we have to ask ourselves every state of society, every moment of history, actually, not just this moment.
And it makes me think, what changed in the last 5 days?
Yeah.
Because, you know, today is Palm Sunday, and just 5 days ago, the crowds were saying Hosanna to the King. And 5 days later, they're saying, crucify him, and we would rather have this horrible criminal out of jail instead of Jesus. And so, man, what changed in those days, literally days?
Yeah. Yeah, we and as you're looking through the story, you know, you realize that it's almost emphatically said, we want Barabbas and we want you to crucify Jesus. You know, see, it wasn't just we want Barabbas. I mean, they made a point to say, we want you to crucify Jesus. And yeah, what had happened? And I think it does. It probably should get our attention here, right? You know, why have people turned against Christ in this way? And maybe one of the things that stood out to me, and so I went looking, was I think earlier in the story at the beginning there, it says that they, you know, they were bringing accusations against Jesus, the elders and the scribes, and, you know. So maybe I thought, well, I wonder what are they saying? You know, what are they accusing him of? So you go back and you see, like, they brought up that he said he would destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days. You know, the one thing that really, really upset them was he claimed that God was his father and making him equal with God, which was, and I think there was that one point in the story where they said, well, do we need to hear any more? You know, he's making God his father. And these are the things that they were accusing him of. And you know, just back to this emphasizing his innocence, there's that one line. It's not a throwaway line, where Pilate says he recognizes that this is basically just all driven by jealousy and envy. You know, this whole mockery of a trial is being driven by people who were jealous of Jesus and envious of him.
And he goes, like, this is a mockery. The blood's on you. It's not on me. Yeah. Like he goes, it's written in scripture that he made it a point to say that.
Yeah.
Like that. Look, I'm saying this guy is innocent, but you guys clearly are not. So it's on you.
Yeah.
He even goes to the point to have to say that to the crowd.
Yeah. I also think it's interesting because this is Matthew, who is a Jew writing to a Jewish audience. So I think where he's saying, it's your responsibility. And verse 25, the people say, yes, his blood is on us and our children. I don't think that this is meant for us as Gentiles to be blaming Jews for Jesus, for killing Jesus. I think, and it has been used in history in that way, but it's for Jews. I think Matthew's really trying to drive home to Jews saying, listen, you killed this innocent man. It's our responsibility. We all shared in this. And maybe also not letting them off the hook later, like blaming somebody else, the Romans who killed Jesus. A lot of blaming and accusing goes on later to shift responsibility. But here he's clearly driving it home. It's our collective responsibility. Mm-hmm. We did this to Jesus. And
Right. And eventually, you know, and at some point you might even be able to say, like, that, you know, that Jesus was on that cross or going to the cross for me. I share in that responsibility as well. You know, every single human being, you know, shares in that, the forces and the intention of Jesus to offer himself. Speaking of Jesus here, in this particular part, these verses, what did you see about Jesus? What stands out to you about him and when he's on trial and he's interacting with Pilate?
I see, first of all, complete submission to, like, the task and, like, the mission before him. we know that Jesus is like master filibuster. When he went, when he was a child, he went to the temple and he like out preached all the best like rabbis, and he wowed them with his like intellect and his knowledge of who God is, obviously because he was God. But so we know that he could talk his way through that. But what I see here is in him not saying anything, like it was just the ultimate submission to like what was laid out before him. It must, I mean, because we know he's fully man too. It must have taken some very like a ton of will power just to like prevent himself from like having to say something, you know. But he just submitted and stayed true to the task that was before him.
Yeah,
and that's probably one of the hardest. I mean, I never really thought of it, but that's absolutely like one of the hardest things he's probably had to do in this, in this stretch, is not say anything.
Yeah, right. And Pilate, I mean, there, I think that's intentionally noted for us that Pilate is amazed that Jesus doesn't respond.
Right.
He's amazed that he just does not defend himself, which is actually a fulfillment of a prophetic word over the Messiah, that he would stand silent as a lamb before the slaughter.
Right.
You know, so it's almost like, to me, and then there's another prophetic word over Jesus, or over the Messiah, that Jesus is fulfilling in Isaiah 50, that he sets his face like a flint, like a stone. In other words, you know, intentional, focused. And you just think, you know, Jesus is, it's so intentional, it's purposeful. He's like aware that he's fulfilling prophecy. He knows what his task is. And there's so much strength that came to me, I think, of in him. Ruth, what were you going to say about Jesus?
Oh, no, just that he was silent and that he didn't try to defend himself at all. I don't think I could be in that position. I think my reaction to try to defend myself is very strong. But Jesus, he could have. And I think Pilate really wanted him to defend himself so that he could release him.
Right.
But Jesus submitted, as Josh said.
It's
very, very, that's a very deep sacrifice that Jesus was making then.
I agree. I think as you're looking at Pilate's actions there, it's almost like he wanted to release him. I'd like to just let this man go.
And he's giving him all these outs. He's
tons.
You know, like, you, I'm giving you these outs, Jesus. Please, like, take these.
And you know, which raises the question, you know, maybe some people are having right now listening to us, well, why didn't he just do it? You know, this is a time, Judea, this area of the world, I mean, it's a famous area now because of the Christian story that's associated with it. But at that time, historically, this part of the world was nowhere. It was like, you know, wherever your home country is, you know, that state or region or section, like, nobody ever goes there. Nothing important ever happens there. If you ever go there, people say, why are you going there? That was Judea. It was like, we call it a backwater, you know, no place, right? And of course, remember the government was, you know, the tension with the Jewish people was very high, and a driving factor almost always was, how do we keep people settled? You know, we don't want an uprising from the Jewish people. We want to try to keep them satisfied, and we don't want any more trouble. So you can see Pilate, I mean, that's why I think Pilate is acquiescing. He doesn't want to upset the Jewish leaders. He doesn't want to say, you know, if one man's life, you know, satisfies an angry crowd here today, this is Rome, we'll do it. You know, I don't want to do it, but, you know, it kind of solves a problem for him.
I mean, that's a really good point historically, or just looking at it from a geographical, historical perspective, that like, this wasn't like it was done in Shanghai. It's like it was done in like some village or like town that's like a hundredth the size of Shanghai.
Yeah.
Like 100 miles out.
Yeah.
And then the one of the most historical moments in history, God chose like this small backwater town to have this trial. For me, because I'm an American, I just think like small town USA, maybe 5,000 to 10,000 places, and it's taking place in a small courtyard, like a small like court in like the center of this town square. Like, that's what I'm thinking. But that's where like all history has like boiled down to this exact moment.
Yeah,
and that's such an interesting thing that the Lord, he quite often chooses these places. you know, he doesn't often choose like the huge places, though he does, but like in a lot of cases he chooses small backwater towns to
Bethlehem. Yeah, you know,
to do his thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So this story goes on from the trial where Pilate then decides, I'll release Barabbas to you, and Jesus, the Messiah, will be crucified. It goes on to say, then the governor's soldiers took Jesus into the praetorium and gathered the whole company of soldiers around him. They stripped him and put a scarlet robe on him, and then twisted together a crown of thorns and set it on his head. They put a staff in his right hand, and they knelt in front of him and mocked him. Hail, King of the Jews, they said. They spit on him and took the staff and struck him on the head again and again. And after they had mocked him, they took off the robe and put his own clothes on him. And they led him away to be crucified. Again, that part of the story, obviously brutal, ugly. You know, your thoughts as you...
I remember sitting down reading the scripture passage, and I thought to myself, and I told this to you during this week when I was researching this, I was like, Pastor, maybe I should go back and watch The Passion. And I didn't need to go back to watch The Passion because it was so vivid. Like the images that they had painted for us in real life or in real imagery, like it's still ingrained in my head and I can see these things. And these are just like these four passages that's descriptive, like in this way. But when you put it to like real picture, mm-hmm. like it really brings to life like what they're really doing to him. And mm-hmm. Not just sacrifice, but like the punishment, the physical brutal punishment that Jesus took. And I didn't need to go back to watch the Passion. It was this brought it all back, and like to the point where like I remember when I was watching the brutal punishment that Jesus was going through on screen, I was sitting there crying because I was like just imagining how difficult of that situation he was going through, mm-hmm. And being able to finally like piece it together with more senses than just my readings, like just reading and like imagining, but like actually seeing what it would possibly look like. But this is a brutal imagery of like what he went through. It's hard to even find the right word to describe like how much pain this is.
I think as Christians and after the story, now looking back on it, you know, we, you know, knowing who this was,
mm-hmm.
you know, and the irony is the soldiers are mocking him, mm-hmm. calling him the king. Oh, you're the king. And he really was the king. Mm-hmm. That was the thing. He really was the king.
Mm-hmm. I really thought this is from the passage beforehand, but because there was no legal basis for Jesus to have the death penalty, the Jewish leaders were really smart, and they said, oh, but he claims to be the king of the Jews, which is a direct threat to Caesar.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And it, you know, we're in this country, and many of you are in other countries where you cannot say anything political against its leader because that automatically triggers a threat. And this is what they're saying. They're saying, you know, it's like going through airport security and joking that you have a bomb in your bag. You are automatically kind of...
Yep.
Yeah.
That joke is like,
you just say,
it's not funny.
It's not funny anymore.
Right. It's not a joke. And that's all they had to say was he's the king of the Jews. So this, that's a direct threat to Caesar. That means you know, and that's the basis that he's crucified then.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so over and over, and they're saying he's the king of the Jews. I think we'll read more where they'll actually, you know, they put the crown of thorns on his head, and they made like a royal robe and put it on him, and they put the sign over him on the cross. Later we'll read. And this is the basis. This is why he's crucified. And of course he is the king of the Jews. Yes. And it's highly, highly prophetic. But all this symbolism is prophetic. It comes from the Old Testament.
Mm-hmm.
It's fulfillment. But the thing that struck me when I was rereading it was the amount of mockery that he went through. I mean, I knew that it's painful. Mm-hmm. So that wasn't a surprise. But just the mockery, even though Pilate knew he was innocent, mm-hmm. And finally agreed, okay, go ahead and crucify him. But he didn't tell the soldiers, okay, go easy on him. Like they mm-hmm. gave him the full package mm-hmm. of crucifixion, which was total humiliation. Mm-hmm. In verse 26, they flogged him, which was whipping him with these little bits of
like spikes in him.
And it was tearing away his flesh. It was mm-hmm. very, very painful. Mm-hmm. But they continued to mock him.
Like as if they needed to mock him, even though he was already going through this like physical like yeah. anguish, like the mocking on
and
top of
the humiliation that he went through really went mm-hmm. home. And we're going to read it in the next passage, but I'm just going to talk about it now. Mm-hmm. That later they offer him wine to drink mixed with gall, and I thought, well, Jesus refused to drink it, and I thought, oh, well, maybe there's some reason, like he wants to truly suffer. He really wants to be in this moment. Mm-hmm. But actually, gall is a bitter herb. And it was more mockery from the guards. Mm. So it was just like, you know, you're really suffering here. I'm going to give you something to drink, but I'm going to put something that makes it nasty in there. Mm. And you see Jesus' humanity because he's refusing to drink it. Like,
right.
But they just kept going. The whole time.
Well,
they're mocking
the fact that they had all these steps of like, well, at this point he's gonna be thirsty, so let's give him something bitter. Like they have thought this form of torture out.
They've done it a lot.
Very well. That's that, right. That they have. Right. Yeah. That they just have all these methods to continue to torture him.
Yeah. And again, you know, we know, considering who it was, it was terrible for any human being to have had experienced this. But, you know, considering who it was, I wondered, you know, as people are shouting at him and the soldiers are mocking mm-hmm. and we're going to read this now and from the crucifixion, things that are said to him, he's mocked as he's dying. Yeah. You know, did he wonder, did he say, I'm doing this for you. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, did he have a sense of, you know, even love for the people who were doing this to him. And let's go on. And the description of the crucifixion, we read, as they were going out, they met a man from Cyrene named Simon, and they forced him to carry the cross. They came to Jesus' cross, and they came to a place called Golgotha, which means the place of the skull. And there they offered Jesus wine to drink mixed with gall, something Ruth has mentioned. But after tasting it, he refused to drink it. And when they had crucified him, they divided up his clothes by casting lots. And sitting down, they kept watch over him there. Above his head, they placed the written charge against him. This is Jesus, the King of the Jews. Mm-hmm. Two rebels were crucified with him, one on his right, one on his left. Those who passed by hurled insults at him, shaking their heads, saying, "You who are going to destroy the temple and build it in 3 days, save yourself. Come down from the cross if you are the Son of God." In the same way, the chief priests, teachers of the laws, and the elders also mocked him. "He saved others," they said, "but he can't save himself. He's the king of Israel. Let him come down now from the cross, and we will believe in him. He trusts God. Let God rescue him now if he wants him. For he said, 'I am the Son of God.'" In the same way, the rebels who were crucified with him also heaped insults upon him. Again, like you were saying, Ruth, it just one thing after another, continually mocked, continually abused, even mm-hmm. as he's dying.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, I remember, we spoke about this earlier today, like trolls existed then too. Like mm-hmm. these days we have internet trolls, right? Mm-hmm. An internet troll is someone who like reads an article or like responds to someone's in the comment section, and they'll just like say something that's just rude or abrasive or like, you know, just something to like really just be speak their mind in the wrong way, because they have this sort of protection behind this like internet identity that they don't have to have the backbone to stand up in front of someone and say those kind of things into their face. And in this instance, you realize, wow, trolls existed back then too. Like in the safety of the crowd of numbers, all of a sudden, these people come out and they start hurling these insults at Jesus, mm-hmm. and saying some of the most cruel, vile things. Mm-hmm. And my question, I think to myself, is would these people have said these things in a smaller setting or to like the person in their face? Mm-hmm. And it just shows that, mm-hmm. We often think that like, oh, you know, trolls are only are a product of this generation or this mm-hmm. or this mm-hmm. time period of how we communicate. But this passage clearly shows that there are those kinds of people no matter what age.
Yeah.
And they were saying these things about Jesus, and Jesus had to like, he couldn't get back on the message board and say, no, da, 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 da. He just had to withstand it live and then have it recorded in the, like in history for everyone to just like see this about him. Mm. That was crazy. You know, like,
You know, it for me, it kind of starts all the way at the beginning in the trial scene, that you have a sense that something more is going on here. You know, I mean, these are horrendous things. The trial, the mockery, the crucifixion, you know, and we'll read of his death in a moment. But that there's a much larger story that's being told here. There's something, there are powers at work here that are even beyond just chief priests and elders and, you know, Roman centurions. You know, there are other powers at work here. And there's kind of this underlying story that's also being told, that Jesus is living out. He knows it, right? He's living out what he and his father.
Yeah.
I'm going to go on to read the description of the death, and we're going to keep moving. From noon until 3 p.m, darkness came over all the land. About 3 p.m, Jesus cried out in a loud voice, "Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani," which means, my God, why have you forsaken me?" And when some of those standing there heard this, they said, "Oh, he's calling Elijah." Immediately, one of them ran and got a sponge, filled it with wine vinegar, and put it on a staff and offered it to Jesus to drink. The rest said, "Now leave him alone. Let's see if Elijah comes to save him." And when Jesus cried out again in a loud voice, he gave up his spirit. At that moment, the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. The earth shook, the rocks split, the tombs broke open, and the bodies of many holy people who had died were raised to life. They came out of the tombs after Jesus' resurrection and went into the holy city and appeared to many people. And when the centurion and those who were with him who were guarding Jesus saw the earthquake and all that had happened, they were terrified and exclaimed, "Surely he was the Son of God." I want to just draw our attention to there are seven things that happen, seven miraculous signs that happen in this story, right? At the death of Jesus, the curtain tears, the earth shakes, the rocks split, the tombs were opened, bodies of saints were raised, they went into the city, and they appeared to many. And you know, this is a part of the story. This is fantastic. You know, right? You know, and there's some real significance in the things that are happening. What are you saying, or what are you reading? You know, and hearing, and these seven miraculous things that all happen around the death of Jesus.
Well, the biggest one for me is that the curtain is torn in two. Mm-hmm. And it's not just torn from the bottom to the top, it's torn from the top to the bottom, and it's 18 meters high, so it's very, very high, and it was a very thick thing. And you're wondering, okay, what is the big deal of that? But in the temple, that curtain was the separating wall or partition between the most holy place where God's presence was and the rest of the temple. And just to let you know how holy it was, the high priest could only go in there once a year after he had done a series of rituals to cleanse himself. And then he could offer those sacrifices in the most holy place. And because of Jesus' death, that curtain is miraculously torn in half. And not, there's no way a human could have done it from top to bottom. And it's saying by Jesus' death that we have access into God's presence. And that is beautiful. Mm-hmm. If you come away with nothing else, Jesus' death opens up us being able to come into the presence of God. Mm-hmm. And That's amazing.
And you know, like the other miracles that happened along with that tearing of the veil, and now us being able to encounter God's full presence. It's like resurrection. First of all, people don't know that we're gonna experience Jesus's resurrection later on, 3 days later. Mm-hmm. But like instantly at that moment, saints rose from the grave. Mm-hmm. Like tombs broke open and saints came up from the grave. Like with the presence of God and the power of the Holy Spirit, when we encounter like his actual presence, like you better expect some amazing miraculous things to start happening. And I think like why if I think about like how life is now, we're living in an unveiled time. Where the veil's been torn. Why do we continue to live non-miraculously? And that's a big question. I think the church has to ask ourselves. We have to ask ourselves as Christians ourselves. But like I think the church needs to ask that question, right? And we need to start reevaluating the way that we see our place with God now. And the things that, you know, miracles should be normal. 7 of them happened here.
And because we're living after the death of Jesus, we're living, you know, and resurrection of Jesus. It is a time of miracles.
I read this commentary about this, and they so I asked you earlier this week, but the commentary was clearly from a different perspective, and they said, well, possibly it just means that maybe like the earthquake happened and then like some tombs broke open and you saw some dead bodies of saints. And then like I was like, well, then how do you explain like verse 53 where they came out of the tombs and then they like appeared to people in the city? And I was like, it clearly states that like they were, because I asked you like, Pastor, are these people really alive or is this like commentary okay? And you're like, well, let's look at 53. Verse 53 says they walked around in the city.
Yeah.
But miracles should be a commonplace thing. We shouldn't be so like blown away by them because we are living in that present period.
Right.
I think the resurrection power was just so great that there was overflow.
Yeah.
Yes. You know, and well, we don't talk about these verses that often because it doesn't really fit in my theology. But that's okay. I'm okay with that. It's just saying that what happened was so powerful that there was overflow. And we should expect to see it in the physical realm as well.
Yes, that's a good point. Yeah.
You know, even with Jesus' death, that the darkness came, there's no way that that was a solar eclipse because Passover is a new moon. It's not possible for that to be an eclipse. There are physical ramifications for what was happening. And that should have been a sign and a testimony to the people, actually. So,
yeah, that's good. You know, because, you know, so oftentimes when we talk about spiritual things, maybe just speak for myself, or, you know, we tend to talk about them like in metaphysically, you know, like in my heart, you know, and somewhere, you know, but this story reminds us that it is metaphysical. It is in my heart, but it's also very real, very physical, material. Rocks, real rocks are split. Yep. You know, bodies come alive and walk into the city. Yeah,
I think we too often separate the two when they're so clearly entwined.
Yeah.
I mean, just humans are a walking, talking example of spirit and physical being entwined.
Yeah.
And in this situation is like it's a very clear example of the spirit and material being clearly entwined, and the reaction of it of to Christ's death very clearly speaking together, and we're so quick to separate the two now, but it's so important for us to realize as mankind, particularly Christians, that those two are together.
Yeah.
Yeah, I really think that God wanted to give a large number of people like the experience of something was happening. Like there's a testimony of people, and even the fact that all of this is taking place on Passover is significant because that meant there were Jews coming from all parts of the world back to Jerusalem to celebrate Passover. I think that also contributed to Jesus' humiliation because there was Jews coming from everywhere. It wasn't a private suffering. He was being crucified and carrying the cross and suffering in front of people coming from out of town.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, there was no technology, but it was like a live stream, okay, of what was happening. Mm. And I believe that that is significant. I believe that God wanted a large group of people from all over the world to see that Jesus was laying down his life and what happened when he died and what happened when he was resurrection. Mm-hmm. I believe that God establishes it so that people will see it.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
And all over the world.
That's good. Yeah. Yeah. Hey, I'm going to, we're going to kind of bring things to our time to an end, and it's been good. I'm enjoying this quite a bit myself. And, but I want to make a reference here to Hebrews chapter 12. You know, when one of the things about the book about Hebrews, it really, in many ways, unpacks a lot of the meaning and significance of the death and life and resurrection of Jesus. But in this particular passage, 12:26-28, it talks about things that are shaken. And it says that at that time, his voice shook the earth, but now he has promised, once more, I will shake not only the earth, but also the heavens. The words once more indicate the removing of what can be shaken, that is created things, so that what cannot be shaken may remain. Therefore, since we are receiving a kingdom that cannot be shaken, let us be thankful and worship God acceptably with reverence and awe, for our God is a consuming fire. Yeah. You know, we're living in a time right now, this is April 2020, and the entire world is in a coronavirus pandemic, and it's really, really shaking our world. Governments, nations, we keep trying to say, well, it's going to be over now, it'll be over then, but no one really knows. And one of the things that happens when we're shaken, whether in our own private lives or in our family or nations are shaken, we find out what matters. And when things start getting shaken, we actually fairly quickly, most of us realize what's important and what is not shaken. Right, and that's what Hebrews 12 is describing, like an earthquake. You know, everything gets shaken. What remained? And I think what we're hearing here and should be hearing is that our faith in Jesus Christ, who died, and his death is a shaking that happens to all of humanity. And what remains is Christ and his kingdom, and this is where we put our hope. And so my hope for all of us today is that as shaken as we are, no sense saying we're not shaken, because we are. I've been shaken by everything that's happened. But I'm also seeing more clearly where my hope lies and where I find my security. And that's in Jesus, who died on the cross and rose again on the third day. And we'll be celebrating that soon.